Good evening. I'm David DeForest in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, the search for a missing Malaysian plane goes underwater. The United States, Japan, and South Korea are planning talks in Washington this week. Those stories and more are coming your way in the next half hour here on VOA's Crossroads Asia. The head of the search for missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 says it's time to take the mission underwater. Angus Houston, who heads the Australian Joint Agency Coordination Center, said today the searchers will try to determine if signals detected earlier by sound locating equipment were from the missing jet's data recorder. A small submarine will use sonar to chart debris on the floor of the Indian Ocean. Houston also said an oil slick, which was found in the area Sunday evening, could be several days, though, before the oil can be tested as for its origin. Authorities have warned that investigators will have lost their chief means of detection when the flight recorder transmitter batteries lose power. Those batteries are designed to operate for just 30 days, possibly a little longer. The plane disappeared 38 days ago. Australia's Prime Minister continues to sound notes of caution, stressing that trying to find anything nearly 5 kilometers below the surface of the Indian Ocean, 1,000 kilometers from land, is a huge task that will not likely end anytime soon. The Boeing 777 with 239 people on board disappeared March 8th during a scheduled flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Media reports say Vietnam has released 2 high-profile dissidents amid international pressure over its human rights record. The 2 men released are identified by activists as blogger Nguyen Thien Trung and democracy campaigner Vy Duc Hoi. The release comes shortly after prominent dissident Cu Huy Ha Vu was let out of jail. Vietnam is a one-party communist state that discourages dissent from government policy. This is Crossroads Asia. Here on the Voice of America, I'm Dave DeForest, sitting in today for Sarah Williams. The South Korean news agency Yonhap reports South Korea, Japan, and the United States will hold 2 days of security talks in Washington beginning Thursday, ahead of President Obama's Asia trip later in the month. Last week, top nuclear envoys from the 3 countries met in Washington on the subject of North Korea. Last month, President Obama brought South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe together for their first meeting since taking office during a nuclear security summit at The Hague. On Wednesday, Yonhap reports that a Japanese diplomat will visit Seoul for a meeting with his South Korean counterpart to discuss the sensitive issue of the sexual enslavement of South Korean comfort women during Japan's occupation in the 20th century. It is billed as the first official meeting specifically on that sensitive subject since Japan's official apology in 1993. That apology, issued by then Chief Cabinet Secretary Yohei Kono, acknowledged the forced use of comfort women for Japanese troops, severely injured the honor and dignity of many women, and vowed never to repeat the same mistake by forever engraving such issues in our memories through the study and teaching of history. Young Shik Bong, a senior research fellow at the Asan Institute for Policy Studies in Seoul, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the issue of comfort women remains an obstacle to improved bilateral relations.
It still remains the one of the most important issues between South Korea and Japan in the minds of South Korean people. According to our survey, it is one of the top 3 issues that Korean people think the biggest stumbling blocks between the 2 countries to upgrade their bilateral partnership, alongside with Dokdo Island, the historical textbooks.
Do you think those other 2 issues will be discussed on Wednesday?
No, it was reported that both sides agreed not to include other issues in this discussion at director levels.
Well, as you know, Japan issued a formal apology back in 1993. It wasn't that enough?
The Kono statement of 1993 is a very significant step forward in the right direction by the Japanese government, but it is not enough for the Japanese government to put an end to this unfortunate chapter of history between the 2 countries, because one, some conservative governments of Japan has denied the legitimacy of the Kono statement in many different fashions. So it has been subject to the doubt by Chinese and South Koreans whether the Japanese government would officially and unequivocally inherit the spirit and the letters of the Kono statement. Two, the Kono statement by and of itself does not represent the Japanese government's position to officially recognize the responsibility for all the atrocities, the kidnaps and forced confinement, as well as other forms of human rights abuses upon the sex slaves. So the Japanese government has not officially recognize its responsibility for the sex slavery.
Is it interesting to you that this meeting comes ahead of President Obama's visit to Tokyo and Seoul?
Yes, I think it's a very positive development. Some people are skeptical that the Japanese government and the Korean government as well only agreed to have this meeting for the sake of appeasing the Obama administration, which hope to see improved bilateral relations between Japan and South Korea, the two allies that President Obama is scheduled to make visit to. But I think this is a first step in the right direction because this will be the first very serious official meeting between the two governments after Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Shinzo Abe's visit to Yasukuni Shrine last year on December.
Well, Youngchuk, it's interesting that you mentioned the Yasukuni Shrine because a cabinet minister for internal affairs and communications, Mr. Yoshitaka Shindo, visited the Yasukuni Shrine on Saturday. That elicited some criticism from both China and South Korea.
I don't think the minister's visit to Yasukuni Shrine will send the entire, negotiations and dialogue between Seoul and Tokyo to square one. But it is a serious dent to the ongoing effort made by the two governments to put the dialogue on the right track.
Yoichiro Sato, professor of international strategic studies at Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University in Japan, does not believe there will be anything substantive coming out of Wednesday's meeting in Seoul.
The Japanese prime minister and his cabinet meeting has already announced that Japan is not going to revise the so-called Kono Statement of 1993, in which the Japanese government basically admitted official involvement and sanctioning of the running of the Brussels for the military officers. And because the government has already said that the statement will remain in place, the Japanese government position is that the issue has been settled. But at the same time, the Japanese government is continuing with its so-called study commissions, in which the public figures, some scholars and women historians and the group of people are meeting to kind of examine the validity of the Kono statement. So the Koreans are not very happy with the Japanese approach of saying on one hand that the statement will remain in place, but at the same time the government is examining the validity of the statement. So the Koreans are not happy about it, and their dissatisfaction is not going to be satisfied unless Japan entirely drops this study commission altogether.
So this issue still rankles the South Koreans 70-plus years on.
Yes, South Korea has incentive to keep this issue alive. And one of the reasons of the movement toward examining the validity of the statement on the Japanese side is the fact that the statement is based on an interview of 16 women who publicly remain anonymous, although the Japanese officials who interviewed these 16 women have information about their identity. But these 16 women were nominated by the South Korean government. There is no large-scale study of the comfort woman issues publicly conducted in a similar way. So the question is, are these 16 women representative of the bigger group of comfort women, or are they subjectively picked by the South Korean government, if not more blatantly manipulated? Those are the concerns of the Japanese revisionist who wants to revise the Kono statement.
Why is this meeting coming before President Obama visits the region?
There must have been a strong pressure from the U.S. government on both President Park Geun-hye of South Korea and Prime Minister Abe of Japan to work on their differences and try to find some compromise. Clearly, I think that the U.S. role in trying to mediate between the two countries is a major factor in this change.
Sato says a Japanese cabinet official's Saturday visit to the controversial Yasukuni Shrine was downplayed as a private, not official visit that was meant to pay respects to those who died in the battle against U.S. forces over Iwo Jima. Yasukuni Shrine is where Japan's nearly 2.5 million war dead, including 14 convicted World War II war criminals, are honored. It is viewed by some as a symbol of Japan's militaristic past. This past week, the limit on the number of what are known as H-1B visas issued by the United States government was reached just a week after they were offered. This has caused much consternation, not only among people outside the United States who had been seeking the limited number of visas, but also by many U.S. companies and schools that seek the skilled people vying for the visas. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Bill Wright, a spokesman for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that issues visas.
It allows American companies and universities as well to temporarily employ foreign workers that have highly specialized knowledge in an occupation that's equivalent to a U.S. bachelor's degree or higher. Now, and it allows the companies to hire these folks and bring them to the United States for an initial 3 years to temporarily work here. And some of these occupations, this is not all inclusive, but it's some they're like computer professionals, engineers, attorneys, business executives, university professors, scientists, researchers, that kind of thing. The program has actually been in existence since when the Congress passed the Immigration Act of 1990, and it was an effort to meet the needs of U.S. employers to be able to bring foreign workers who have the specialized knowledge to the United States and to work in for a particular company for a limited amount of time. And again, it's a non-immigrant visa, and it allows people to come here temporarily for 3 years. Now, they can extend one time for an additional 3 years, so a total time of about 6 years in the United States.
There are limitations on the number of such visas, and these limitations have been reached rather quickly recently, have they not?
They have been. In fact, this year we just finished the FY 2015 H-1B season. We opened it up on April 1st, which we open every year at April 1, and we had enough petitions and applications to reach the congressionally mandated cap within the first 5 days. And we announced that April 7 has to be open. The filing period has to be open for 5 working days. So it went through the weekend, and we closed it out on April the 7th. The congressionally mandated cap is 65,000 visas per fiscal year. And there's an additional 20,000 petitions that are approved for those that have U.S. master's degree or higher. So they're exempt from that 65,000 cap. So totally 85,000 per fiscal year. And this year we met it within the first week. Last year we met it within the first week.
If I am someone hearing this news, should I be discouraged and knowing that the caps have been reached so quickly? And what can I do? What's my alternative? What's it look like in the future? What do I have to do?
I don't think a potential employee or worker that is interested in this program should be discouraged. I certainly would prepare myself well in advance, and I think that traditionally we've been able to show over the last few years that that people really need to start getting their documentation together. And we have a fantastic information on our website at uscis.gov that talks about the program in very, very good detail and explains what you need, what kind of documentation you need. And we encourage people, knowing full well that we're going to open the season on April 1 every year, that date does not change. So employers need to be prepared well in advance, and those that believe they have the wherewithal and the experience and the documentation that they need to qualify, they should be prepared. And maybe talk to some immigration advocates, talk to some immigration counselors, lawyers, and attorneys to be able to prepare yourself well in advance.
There is an effort in the United States Senate to increase the number of H-1B visas threefold. It's a bipartisan effort, and it includes two Democrats and two Republicans. Ira Melman spoke with one Republican senator sponsoring the measure, longtime Senator Orrin Hatch from the state of Utah.
Well, keep in mind, these are people that we educate here who want to stay here and work in some of our really high-tech industries to a large degree. And then we push them out of the country because of our stupid laws. Let's just look at the facts. On Monday, the State Department announced that we've already reached the cap on H-1B visas for the entire year. Let me repeat that. Just over 4 months into the year, we're closing the door on any more high-skilled foreign workers, many of whom are American-trained. They want to work here, and they want to help American companies grow the American economy. I don't see how anybody can believe that that's a good thing to push them out of the country. In fact, Canada's come down and advertised for them so they can get them, and we need them. We need every one of these people that we can keep. You know, these are good-paying jobs. They're being sent overseas instead of staying right here and helping to grow our still-struggling economy. And for too long, our country just has not been able to meet the demands for workers in the STEM fields, that is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. We have increasingly enrollment in U.S. universities in these fields, and a lot of the people who enroll are foreign students. And we continue to send these foreign students back to their home countries after graduation, despite the jobs available here and their desire to work here. So it's critical that we not only recognize this shortage of high-skilled workers, but also understand why it exists. And if you put it simply, U.S.-based companies have a great need for these trained people in these STEM fields. But at least right now, what we see and hear from the tech community is that there are not enough Americans trained and ready to fill these jobs. We can't continue to just hope that American companies don't move these jobs overseas, because they are. We can't continue to ignore this problem. It's that simple.
And what does your proposal call for?
Well, our proposal would allow them to stay here, and if I had my way, even ultimately, if they wanted to apply for, it gives them the legal status to stay here and work here. And down the line, if I had my way, we would even give them an opportunity to become citizens if they wanted to. You know, the countries where these jobs are going, China, India, et cetera, they would love to have their American-educated PhDs, and other highly educated individuals return and boost their economies. So what I believe we need to do is address the immediate short-term need to provide American employers with greater access to high-skilled workers, while also addressing the long-term need to invest in STEM education right here. It's a two-step approach that I have that will enable our country to grow and help us compete in today's global economy. These are things that are pretty important.
VOA's Ira Melman speaking with Bill Wright, a spokesman for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch. Well, thank you for joining us today on The Voice of America. For Crossroads Asia, sitting in for Sarah Williams, I'm Dave DeForest.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Lin Yang.
I'm Aisha Holly.
And I'm Madeline Eck.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday,
beginning April 28th for The Voice of America's Now.
China has promised Hong Kong citizens that they will be able to vote for the territory's chief executive by 2017 and for its parliament in 2020. But as the deadlines grow nearer for universal suffrage, rules on how people will vote remain divisive. A consultation in Shanghai between Hong Kong politicians and Beijing officials ended with some Hong Kong pro-Democrats refusing to take part in the negotiations. Rebecca Valley has more.
The Shanghai meeting is part of a negotiation to hammer out the rules of how Hong Kong will vote in 2017. Debate about the details have divided politicians in Hong Kong, especially in the pro-democracy camp, where some lawmakers are insisting on public or party nomination of candidates, which Beijing has strongly refused. Pan-Democrat legislator Ronnie Tong says that 14 of the 27 Hong Kong lawmakers in his camp had agreed to go to Shanghai for consultation.
On arrival of the first batch, one of the legislators was found to be in possession of June 4th material, which the Chinese custom regarded as illegal matters. They tried to persuade Mr. Leung, the legislator in question, to not to bring in those illegal material, which Mr. Leung refused, and as a result of which, he returned to Hong Kong without actually getting into Shanghai.
Other legislators in the pro-democracy camp boycotted the meeting in support of Leung. Tong was one of the 10 who eventually sat down with Beijing officials.
I think the meeting was very cordial. Each side put forward their thinking and supporting arguments in support of their respective stance. There was no consensus reached, and nobody would expect that the such a complicated issue as democratic reform in Hong Kong could be resolved in one meeting.
Beijing has made it clear that it doesn't wish Hong Kong people directly pick the candidates for the chief executive job. Instead, authorities want what they call a broadly representative nominating committee to choose candidates to run in a general election. Authorities in Beijing say such arrangement is based on the basic law, Hong Kong's mini constitution, which went into effect after the city's handover to Beijing in 1997. But some Democrats in Hong Kong fear such a setup would exclude from the race politicians who take a critical stance on the mainland. They have pushed for a more democratic selection of candidates, including giving people and parties in Hong Kong the right to come up with names. Wang Yuncheng, a professor of politics at Lingnan University in Hong Kong, says that while the meeting in Shanghai was a first effort to compromise, the divide still looms large. A number of pan-Democrats, including Liang Guoxiong, the lawmaker who was barred at the airport Friday night, said they are interested in further meetings in Hong Kong proposed by mainland officials. A 5 months public consultation is underway in Hong Kong and might provide more information about what public opinion thinks of the plans proposed so far. For VOA News, this is Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America, recapping our top news story at this hour. The head of the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 says it's time to take the mission underwater. Angus Houston, who heads Australia's Joint Agency Coordination Center, said today searchers will try to determine if signals detected earlier by sound locating equipment were indeed from the missing jet's data recorder. A small submarine will use sonar to chart debris on the floor of the Indian Ocean. Houston also said an oil slick was found in the area Sunday evening, but it would take several days before the oil could be tested for its origin. Well, we thank you for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia program here on The Voice of America. By the way, you can find more news 24 hours a day on our website. It's voanews.com. Crossroads Asia is also available for download. Visit our podcast page for voanews.com, or you can search for Crossroads Asia in iTunes. Take a look. It might be interesting. Thank you for joining us again for today's Crossroads Asia. This is Dave DeForest sitting in for Sarah Williams. Have a good evening.